You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
All right, let's get back to some boring subjects.
Understand the risk to our country.
Freedom brings people together.
You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
Welcome to the program. My name is Chris Spangle. Today we are talking to Dr. Eric Larson, who is the host of the newest show on the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network, Paradox, P-A-R-A-D-O-C-S. We're going to talk about how he has approached his program and then also talk a little bit about how he's approached it during COVID. So stay tuned right after these words.
Warning, this show is for adults by semi-adults, so the language is sometimes strong and offensive.
I don't know what I said.
Welcome to the Chris Spangle Show. Our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. If you struggle to understand politics, we explain it from an independent, libertarian point of view. With all of the irreverence it deserves, we toss out the screaming heads, put people before political parties, and give context to the news to make you think. Now, here's our host, Chris Spangle, a 15-year veteran of politics and media.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us here on the Chris Spangle Show. My name is Chris Spangle. And before we start, I want to thank all of the members of Wall Plus, We Are Libertarians Plus, as you're the reason that this show and network exist, and you can support the show by visiting joinwallplus.com and learn about all the great benefits of subscribing. Like, you get 1,500 different past episodes. All the archives are on there. You get commercial-free shows. And you get some merch. You also just get to support the show and the network. And trust me, if you get value out of this, then please give value back to us. We are always growing and expanding. We didn't grow too much last year. I was frankly burned out and had a lot going on, and COVID and moving and marriages. But we are back in fighting shape, looking lean this year, and we're so happy you're with us. And we want to especially thank our $100 a month members, John Pusilo, Casey Feldposh, Lars Nordskog, Jake Edel, Matthew Durbin, Reinhold, Christy Avery, and Jason Doolittle. So thank you both so much. Now, our guest today is Dr. Eric Larson, who is the host of the Paradox podcast, and it is where he, a doctor, a trained anesthesiologist up in Michigan, gets together with another doctor, and they talk about healthcare innovation, and that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today. We're going to talk about his background. We're going to talk about medical innovation, how he has approached his show with things like COVID. And a little bit about his podcast. He has a great show, and the number one thing that we are always asked about is, how do we reform healthcare? How can we learn a little bit more about this? And his show is a great insight into new ways of medicine. We talk a little bit about direct primary care physicians and that model of medicine that kind of opts out of the just sort of the status quo of healthcare. And I'm really excited that he has joined the network because he's, as you will hear, a very level-headed, thoughtful person who's just trying to look at things the way that we look at here at the Chris Spangle Show about, all right, what are the facts, the figures, what is everybody saying? Let's kind of think of this in a consensus way, put this together and figure out what's true. And so we're happy to have him on the network. He's going to be a great, great show, great resource for you listeners who want to know more about medical innovation, what's going on with COVID, and just so you can get all kinds of information to help make good decisions for you and your family. So I'm not going to blather on. I know I want to get to the interview here with Dr. Eric Larson of the Paradox Podcast. As I mentioned in the open, I am excited to welcome Dr. Eric Larson to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. It is a welcome addition, and honestly, when we did last year a survey of our audience, we had probably a couple hundred entrants, and healthcare was the number one issue, both health insurance, healthcare, and we were really excited when Dr. Larson reached out to us to bring his podcast to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. It is called Paradox, The Paradox, P-A-R-A-D-O-C-S, because he talks to another doctor, so it's a paradox. It's a
dad joke.
Yes, it's a dad joke. And I really enjoy the show. I've learned a lot listening to it. I think you will too. I'd love for you to go subscribe on wearelibertarians.com or in anywhere. And so with that, I want to welcome Dr. Eric Larson both to the network and to the show. Thank you so much for coming aboard. We're really excited to have you on the network.
Well, thanks so much, Chris. I'm real excited to be here and I'm part of the network too.
Yeah. You know, you have a great voice. You reminded me of my own doctor, Dr. Kerstaff. And when I'm talking to him, it's almost like, do they teach you AMSR in medical school, like to have that like, you have like this very nice soothing voice. So, you know, when the pandemic kills all of us, you deliver in the podcast, these big concepts in just such a friendly way. And I really wonder if that's like a doctor thing. Did they teach you how to have such a nice voice?
It's funny because I always thought my voice was terrible, right? You know,
you're used to, right? Me too.
Well, I'm an anesthesiologist, right, by trade. And so I have to really calm people down and just so, you know, take a nice deep breath in and deep breath out all the way from nose down to your toes. Breathe in, breathe out, wax on.
Yeah, somebody's going to wreck their car.
Yeah, only 40-year-olds get that joke when I do that in the OR. But with the Karate Kid reference. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I just started the podcast, and I've had a number of people tell me that, which I've found strange because I you know, like anyone, I think you don't sound like you think you sound when you record your voice and listen to it later. So it never sounds like me, but I'm like, okay, well, I'm glad people like it.
I hate my voice too. And I've worked in radio for 20 years and it's like a thing. Like if you hear yourself, that's not what my head sounds like. The voice in my head sounds like. So it's just like a common thing. And that's always when I have a podcast clients, I'm always like, you're gonna hate your voice, you're gonna listen back to it, it's never gonna go away, just accept it, like it's just a thing. Like, and I apologize for being so sporadic. You and I had actually a podcast set up for mid-December, but I got total and complete laryngitis right before the wedding and it didn't come back. I lost my voice December 1st and it didn't come back till December 24th. And you heard it. It was very squeaky. So I don't know if I have nodes, or maybe you can diagnose me live on air, but it was I have the worst laryngitis. If I get a cold now, it's just, it immediately, so please, what's wrong with me, doctor?
I have no idea.
All right.
That's why I went to anesthesia, so I don't have to.
You sound like my in network doctor. I have no idea what's wrong with you.
I'll refer you to someone who can figure it out.
Yeah, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself. So, where did you start out? Why did you become a doctor? What are your credentials? You mentioned anesthesiologist, which is really one of the most high pressure jobs. My mom's an RN, and she always tells me that you guys have the most stressful job of anybody in the OR.
Yeah, our job is actually probably 95% boredom and 5% terror. And that's, it's probably more like 99-1. The better, you know, if you can work your practice the right way. So,
doesn't know, they're the people who put you under the gas and put you to sleep and keep you asleep.
Right. I mean, the joke is it's $10 to go to sleep; it's $1,000 to wake up. Right. when it comes to anesthesia, it's funny because I always think to myself, you know, my day's not very exciting. You know, everyone says, oh, it's a high pack, it's stressful, whatever. And then I had a day like today where I walk in, someone's had they had neck surgery yesterday on their spine and on their cervical spine, their neck spine. And they had a hematoma, so it was closing their airway and they couldn't breathe in the ER. And they came down, and I had to intubate them to help out one of my partners. And so I'm like, oh yeah, this is kind of why it's sort of a big deal, because, you know, it can be kind of stressful and you just sort of forget those things when it turns out fine. So
it's like the thing, you're a professional because you know what to do when things go wrong. And yes, Rarely things go wrong because you're a professional, but when they do, you want somebody with experience like yourself.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. And I talk to the medical students who work with me and I say, you know, when it comes to being a professional in really anything, things go wrong all the time. And there are days when, for whatever reason, just not working for you, right? Like, you know, there are days when Michael Jordan couldn't hit a shot, but eventually he as a professional, you sort of work through, you figure out what's wrong and you correct it usually, right? And you recover. And that's sort of what being a professional is. And so in medicine, you know, I'll see these med students have trouble putting IV in or maybe intubating someone, putting a breathing tube in. And I said, you know, there are days when I can't get an IV in for a couple tries. And then, but the professional is the one who just gets through and can manage to still perform the task, even though they're having a rough day for whatever reason.
So let's hop back to like, why did you become a doctor? I mean, how did you decide on anesthesiologist? What was the process like? Where did you go to school? Give us your credentials, because that's very important. We're going to talk about COVID today, and everybody needs to suss you out.
Well, it was 3 weeks online. It was actually right. So I went at undergraduate, I liked math and science. I went, did my undergrad at University of Michigan. I decided to go engineering. My father was a physician, and I thought, oh, that seemed pretty interesting, but I don't know. Maybe I want to be a doctor. I don't know. He's not a doctor in the traditional sense that, you know, he didn't have to take call. He worked at student health actually at Michigan State University during my years growing up during elementary school and high school. So he had a very, you know, non-traditional job. He didn't work holidays, didn't work weekends. It was kind of a boring job for him because he used to be the everything doctor up in northern Minnesota, and that my mom just couldn't handle it. I mean, he was like, you know, the coroner, the delivered all the babies, oh, and all, everything. He loved it, but she's like, people come to the door and they have problems and ask her, and he's always on call, right? And so that was sort of the trade-off. So anyway, so I thought, well, maybe if I go to college, I like, maybe I'll just do engineering, because if I don't end up liking engineering, I can just maybe go to med school. And I did nuclear engineering and I got my bachelor's in that. And probably about between my junior and senior year, I realized that, I don't know. I just didn't feel like an engineer. So maybe I'll just med school. And so that's kind of how I ended up in med school. I ended up at University of Iowa. Met my wife there, who's a pediatrician. We got married. We ended up doing a residency training there too, after traveling all over the Midwest, and realized that we liked the training programs there. So I was in Iowa City for 8 years and then wanted to get back to Michigan. I grew up in Lansing area, and then settled in West Michigan, Grand Rapids area. And I've been in private practice ever since. I'm actually a faculty at Michigan State University's College of Medicine. All of our staff are. And so I teach medical students and residents occasionally. And then I sort of sub-specialize a little bit in perioperative pain, which is basically nerve blocks. And so I kind of do everything. I take care of little babies all the way to, you know, people who are 100 years old. But I don't do the high-risk peds. I don't do the cardiac stuff, mainly because I don't really like doing that stuff. And I do a lot of outpatient stuff. So I work at 8 different locations around town, mostly outpatient procedures with a couple and regular hospitals.
And so you have a podcast, the Paradox Podcast, and you started this, I mean, was it April of 2018? I just saw, I mean, it was
right.
Going way back. Why did you decide that you wanted to start a podcast? And what was the podcast about until, roughly March of 2020?
There are certain things in medicine that I didn't like and that I wanted to sort of talk about. I had 3 episodes in mind. And so I thought, well, I can do a couple episodes. No one knows who I am. I'm a nobody, right? I'm not anyone famous. So maybe I'll get a couple people to listen. And I was inspired by, you know, some libertarians and also just podcasts in general, in the sense that I used to listen to the radio, because the last thing I wanted to do leaving the OR is listen to more music. And I always kind of like talk radio, but you could never find, you know, the niche, whatever it is. Like, I want to listen to Michigan State basketball. I don't want to listen to things about hockey and people calling in and commercials and all that stuff. And so I got into podcasts. And then a couple people just said, when I was listening to them, they said, you know, you can start your own podcast. I thought, okay, well, I guess I'll do that and see what happens. And my wife, you know, rolled her eyes, but was supportive as always. And, you know, I said, I promise I won't spend a lot of money doing this. And you can actually do
That's like, I'll just buy one gun. I won't spend much money. And those people, I just need one grill. Yeah.
And so I started with a plan of just talking about a couple things: direct primary care, the credentialing process for physicians, and just healthcare in general, the fact that it's a third-party payer system and it doesn't work very well. And I was very pessimistic about healthcare in general. And it wasn't until I started my show and started talking to all kinds of people who are doing innovative, interesting things in the healthcare space, despite regulations, despite the laws, and despite all the sort of obstacles put in their place, people find really cool ways of delivering care and doing things. I mean, the ones everyone knows about who are libertarians, you know, like the Surgery Center of Oklahoma with Keith Smith, but all kinds of other people doing, you know, telehealth and just other ways of delivering care. It's been really encouraging to me in general. And it's actually changed the way our practice works too. We've doing things different with our insurance, for instance. And so that was sort of the genesis of the show. And I just started talking, and I actually have had pretty good following considering I don't have any, you know, big backing, and I'm still working.
How dare you? Well, you do now. No, it's you know, it's hard to start a podcast and just out of nowhere, but you know, you have managed to keep it light and interesting, and I'll give a shout out to Vaughn, one of our staff researchers. He has loved your podcast from the beginning and has listened to almost every episode, I think. And he was super excited when you were coming on, because he just said, like, this is a natural fit, talking about some of the evolution. So when you look at some of the things that made you more positive about your industry, like, what are a couple highlights? What are two or three things that stood out in innovation and medical care that made you go, all right, maybe I'm being too negative about this particular space?
Yeah, I mean, I think direct primary care is the one that jumps out. And that's just a different way of delivering primary care, where you use a membership-based model and you move away from insurance. And in along those same lines, there are a number of people who are providing surgical care, who are providing other sorts of ways of care that don't use traditional insurance. And so I think those are very encouraging to me. I've also gone a year and a half almost without insurance, tried out with a sharing ministry and saw how that worked. And I think seeing the alternatives and recognizing that when it comes to innovation and it comes to entrepreneurs, you see when there's a large enough delta, you know, a gap between what you can deliver care and what it actually costs, like off the rack, you know, the rack rate, and you recognize there's such a huge amount of money that can be saved, that even if, you know, no matter how many regulations you put through, how many laws you pass, when there's an alternative that is so much that delivers better quality and at a lower price, it will succeed. And I'm much more encouraged by that than I was in the past. You know, I think a good example is, like, you know, look at Uber, right? Like, no one's going to want to go back to just having taxi cabs anymore. No one's going to want to go back to a life without Airbnb or, you know, other online options that dramatically lower the cost of you know, unlock capital, right? And so I think although there are large, sweeping, overarching problems within healthcare and all the industries, there are people who are finding ways to get around these things, mainly because of cost and the quality they can get. And so I'm encouraged, and I think that's where the real change comes, right? It's not sweeping legislation is what we see; it's on TV, but where the real change has happened is people who find ways to solve problems we didn't even know we had, or ways of solving it, things we have never dreamed of.
Well, that's one of the things that I love about podcasts, is that you can get granular on things. Like if you like you mentioned about you know, sports talk, that industry is NFL. Maybe some NBA, maybe some, you know, unless there's a scandal in baseball and hockey, then you'll talk about that. maybe you'll talk about racing, but mostly just in the NFL, even in the summertime. And it's so homogenized, and so much of our culture, I think, has just been centralized through these mega corporations that it sort of becomes a little uninteresting. And so with podcasts, you can niche down. So if you're watching the 6 o'clock news, you're just sort of assuming everything in the medical industry is terrible because they cover politicians talking about how bad it is. But, you know, I'm looking at actually switching doctors to a DCP, a direct primary care physician. So people can go back and listen to my podcast with Matt Allen about health insurance and me looking into new health insurance schemes. I decided to stay with my employer-based insurance. But we looked at the Christian ministry, like you mentioned. We looked at some high-risk insurance plus the Christian ministry. And when I had COVID this past September, when I had Delta, you know, my doctor was like, well, I don't know, just take some Tylenol, you'll be fine. You know, there was no discussion of, I don't know, if you're feeling this or that way, maybe go to the hospital for the antibodies or some of these different protocols. There, you know, it wasn't even talking to him. It was just like through messaging through the nurse. And then in December, when I got really sick, you know, before the wedding and after the wedding, I think I got pneumonia. My mom, who's an RN, was like, you really need to call your doctor because you shouldn't sound like that. You're really bad. You know, and he prescribed some antibiotics, but never had me come in. He just couldn't see me, no time, no ability. And I'm just thinking about these experiences. I've never really been a sick person. I mean, I've only ever really had, you know, a few colds here and there. But for 6 months, I've just, like COVID ring me for a month, and I got three or four colds. And it's really, Dr. Larson, you know what it's like, you have kids. When you have a kid going to daycare or to school, now all of a sudden they're bringing everything home to you. But I mean, talk about the DCP, because I'm looking at my situation going, I'm 38, I'm not getting any younger, I'm still overweight, you know, despite my best efforts. What happens when something significant happens, or how can I even prevent that if my doctor I haven't seen in 5 years or talked to in person, you know, on the phone, even when I have these big issues? Right. You know, it just doesn't seem to make any sense to me why I would continue to see somebody. There's got to be a better way. And then my friend Matt told me about DCPs. Can you talk about what that is, what that, you know, spells for the medical industry, and do you participate in it as a personal choice?
Right. So I think there are two ways to look at DPC, and that's direct primary care. One is from the vantage point of the patient, and that'd be you and me, because I have a DPC doc too. In fact, actually, my doctor is the one who was on, I think it was my episode 2, why I left medicine and went to DPC. And Dr. Ahmad is great, and I've actually had her on a couple times. So if you look at it from the patient perspective, excuse me, it's advantageous because it's sort of like you're looking for someone who's to maintain your health versus someone who's just treating you for episodic care. Right now, when you go in for care in the traditional sense, you know, you're calling because maybe you have an annual physical, but for the most part, people, like, I get sick, I call in and I have to get it scheduled. And those offices make their money by you showing up, right? That's how they make their money. You know, HMOs, they actually have capitation, so they get paid by the patient, but they're still making money with copays as you're coming in for most traditional insurance. There's no incentive for them to keep you out of their clinic. They want as many as they can, but they also want it not to take much time. And so people all feel that, right? Like, you go in and the doc's trying to see 6 people an hour or maybe even more, you know, you're seeing other providers, you're seeing, you know, nurse practitioners or PAs, or, you know, you're spending most of your time in the nurse room waiting around, and then you get your 3 minutes with the doctor and you get their prescription for whatever. It's very much a mill in that sense. You know, you're just kind of, it's a churn, because they want to get their revenue is by how efficiently they can get people in and out, but they have to get people in order to make money. And so they, you know, want to get you out. Direct primary care kind of turns that on its head, right? So direct primary care is a membership base. So you say, hey, I want you to take care of me. They say, great. It's $50 a month, right? People are used to membership-based care for all sorts of things, you know, from your subscription, you know, streaming service to gym memberships, whatever. And so for them, they say, okay, it's $50. And so the value proposition for the doc is, well, I know I have a set amount of patients with a certain amount of revenue. I know what my revenue is, and I know it's, you know, $50 per person, let's say. I know how many patients I need in order to maintain a salary. So I can see about usually it turns out to be about a fifth or a quarter of the amount of patients I'd have to have in a regular patient panel if I was working a traditional insurance model. So now, instead of having 2,000, 2,500 patients in my panel, I only have 500, maybe 750. You know, it depends how aggressive you want, how much you want to work. So you know your patients way better than you did before. Also, if I have 24/7 access to the doc and I can usually use email, telehealth, texting, I can, you know, say, hey, I've got this going on or whatever. And, you know, most things don't need to require you to go into the office to be seen. Some things do. But if you don't, you can prescribe something if I've seen you 10 times, I know you get ear infections all the time. I don't need to have you come in so I can look at your ear, right? Or whatever it might be. I can just go ahead and prescribe you the medications to the pharmacy. In which case, you know, you've saved yourself a visit. It's convenient for you. It's convenient for me as the doc. I'm just taking care of people, and I'm only seeing maybe 4 or 5 patients in my office per day. But that also means that if you come in for, let's say, your annual physical, we can spend like an hour, hour and a half. It's no big deal. We can chat and I can find out all about you. Also, a lot of states allow physicians to distribute medications in addition to prescribing them, which means they are dispensing, as the term. So it's really inexpensive. And so I can then give you most of the generic drugs. Most of them don't have controlled drugs in their office, but, you know, your hypertensive medications or for your thyroids, they can distribute that to you, which gives them, you know, and they usually just charge at cost, what wholesale price is. So it's pennies on the dollar compared to what you pay even with the copay at the pharmacy. But also, the added benefit is, if I'm that doc prescribing it, I'm like, hey, Chris, I haven't seen you for 2 months. I gave you a 1-month supply for your antihypertensive medication. You shouldn't have any left, right? Or why are you getting a refill? That was supposed to be a one time a day drug, not twice a day. And so you can pick up on problems a lot sooner than others. And
You're almost incentivized to keep your patients healthy as opposed to just churning them when they're sick.
Absolutely. Right. And our office, a good example for our office for anesthesia is we had a person who was our IT guy, and he would come in and you pay him every time he came in to fix something. We then switched to a service where like, okay, we pay you guys this much a month, you get everything moving. And their whole incentive was to stay out of our office, to not have things break. Yeah. And so they can fix things remotely. They can, and as long as things are working, you don't care how it's done. You just want it to be as smooth as possible. And, you know, as efficiently, right, as a business. And your body is no different, right? I mean, you want people to know how you work and how to keep you healthy. And the nice thing about the DPC is, now if I've removed the whole element of billing and coding and mostly a lot of the electronic medical record keeping, which is generally most of that is nonsense stuff like, you know, I'm asking you every time if you're, you know, wear a seatbelt or something. And I can tell you as an anesthesiologist, I mean, I care globally that you wear a seatbelt, but I don't need to know that information when you come to the hospital. Right. But that's all asked every person who comes in, right? So there's a lot of stuff, garbage that goes into EMRs. So if you remove a lot of that stuff from the primary care office, it makes it not only more enjoyable visit for the doctor, you know, you're actually focused on the patient a lot more. You can find out more about them. And so just, it makes the process a lot simpler, and you have no overhead, or not no overhead, but you have dramatically less overhead, right? You have an office with maybe, you know, it's a tiny waiting room because don't have a lot of people waiting. You have a couple of basic lab supplies. You have one exam room probably. You don't have to have any off staff at all. My doctor doesn't have any, but she kind of has a virtual assistant, but for the most part, she does all the scheduling herself. She can hire someone to do it if she wants to. But your overhead is tiny compared to what it was before. And so the amount of patients and the amount of revenue you generate is a lot less. And so it just makes a lot more sense. It's a lot simpler. These are difficult to scale. And so that would be one of the drawbacks of something like this. Like, you know, if you want to have everyone seeing direct primary care, you got to have a lot more practices, and they're also these little mom and pop sort of operations. You can scale them up a little bit. And so that's the thing they're sort of trying to figure out right now. But
so does a DPC basically take like a pay cut to not have the hassle, or is it a little more lucrative, you know, for a doctor?
It can be either. And so that's the thing. So it depends on how hard you want to work if you're direct primary care. I mean, part of it is trying to find patients because of course you can imagine, you know, it's a different way of practicing. Most people are not kind of used to it. A lot of people think, oh, it's like concierge. And yeah, some places you could just call it concierge, but it's concierge usually is involves insurance, and then you pay on top of insurance. That's usually what people refer to in concierge. And so if you talk to direct primary care docs, they'll say, yeah, I'm not concierge, I'm direct primary care. But I've talked to some people who said, you know what, I just call myself concierge, even though it's membership based, because that's what people know and understand. And they're actually, maybe it's like a higher end of town, part of town. It actually works for them, like from a marketing standpoint.
When you look at the DCPs and where they're located in Indianapolis, it's in Carmel. It's in the northern part of the city. Yeah. Go ahead.
I would just say one other thing about the direct primary care. It, because of you're sort of running the business as a doc, you can tailor it so you can be really busy and make more money. You can do it less and make less. You can do a lot of free care. You can provide, you can have alternative ways of paying things. Like you can just pay every other month. You can pay every week. You can say someone could, you know, they're not going through hard times. You can let them go for a couple months. Things you can't do in the normal, insurance-based business. My doctor, a lot of her, she speaks Spanish. So a lot of her patients actually don't have any insurance. They don't have really, they just pay cash or something because I think like half her population are Spanish speaking, maybe even more than that. So she can serve, and she's very affordable. I mean, $65 for a month. That's pretty affordable for people who don't make much money, right? I mean, that's like a cell phone coverage. And so that's something that is within reach for people who don't have many means. And so it's actually much more affordable than trying to like carry an insurance policy, you know, with copays and all that kind of stuff too.
So here's my fear about doing it. And I think I have a very common male problem. I am both simultaneously a horrible hypochondriac that spends too much time Googling. I'm
Dr. Google.
Especially as I've gotten like become a sickly person for over the past 5 months, like, well, obviously I have an enlarged heart. There's just no way around it. Meanwhile, it's stress. So I'm just a terrible hypochondriac, but I also don't want to go to a doctor that will pay attention to me because I don't want them to find things that are wrong with me. I think, you know, if I go to the doctor, surely I had two pieces of Toblerone earlier, so obviously I'm diabetic. You know, like, it's just, it's like that weird thing where you are overthinking all of this stuff. And I just think that's like a very common, I'm sure every man listening to this kind of has that thing, especially as you get to 38 and you've never had to go to the doctor, didn't have health insurance my entire 20s, never have had a procedure of any kind. Like, I just haven't had much use for doctors. My parents and grandparents haven't been sickly. So, you know, should I go to the doctor? Like, how do you deal with that kind of, I don't know that I want to go to the doctor, even though I'm 38 and 250 and you know, everyone else in my family's on blood pressure medicine. Like, what do you say to the people who are listening that kind of think like me about that stuff?
Well, I understand it. I mean, I'm there too, in some sense. I think, you know, there's always a fear. You're always afraid to lift up the hood because you don't know what you're going to find. And we say that all the time in medicine, right? Like, someone comes in, they got belly pain. We think, oh, they got appendicitis. They do a CT scan, like, oh, it's not appendicitis, but there's a mass in your kidney. We're not quite sure what that is. And then you get that worked up and then weird stuff happens. I mean, so when I'm as an anesthesiologist, I see all this where I'm at the very end of the line for the most part, in the sense that, you know, you've had your 2 months of workup and then you end up with me.
Right.
I mean, I had a guy who came in once and he wanted to get his hip replaced. And he's an older gentleman, obviously. So, you know, one of the standard workups is you get an EKG. Well, kind of funny. So they did another heart exam. They go, oh, well, it turns out that you've got some blocked coronary vessels. So you're going to need you can't get your heart done, or you can't get your hip done. We're going to have to do bypass surgery. So he had bypass surgery. And then when he's in the hospital, he started having some problems, and they realized that he had a blocked artery in his neck, and so he had to have that.
See,
fixed.
As you're saying this, I'm having all of these pains in all those places.
Well, you're not 72, Chris. So don't feel too
no,
bad.
Don't know where I've been.
Right. So, and then of course he had belly pain, and then they found a mass in his kidney. And so I saw him for his hip surgery, but it had been a year since the whole thing started. So that's a fear people have. I mean, I have that too. Like, I go in, I'm like, well, I'm going to get my PSA for prostate lab test. Maybe it's elevated. I don't know. I mean, if I don't look, I'll never know, right?
Right.
Until it's too late, right? And so the nice thing about having someone who knows you and who is like, you know, your doctor, and you visit with them once, and maybe, maybe you're a little hypochondriac, maybe you're someone who's like worried about all these things, they will know you and they'll know, like, okay, it's Spangle. I'm not going to be worried about this. Or, hey, this is a guy who's never mentioned this before, or he's got these risk factors. You're going to know those a lot better. And so I think in many ways that it'll be advantageous to you to have someone who knows you well, because what you don't get in the clinic, probably where you're going now or most places, is you don't get that relationship that you have where they really know who you are and know what to pay attention to. My wife's a pediatrician, and she'll talk all the time about patients who she knows the family. It's like, okay, this person's calling, there must be something wrong, versus this person's calling and they kind of are sort of worried about everything all the time. And so I'm not gonna be quite so good. And so I'm going to be in reassuring mode, right? As opposed to, and so, you know, that's part of being a primary care doc and knowing people. You have to kind of know where you're supposed to be. Are you reassuring someone and saying, you know, it's okay, you're going to be right? Or is it going to be, that's something concerning, let's take a look into it. Or this person's never mentioned this before. You know,
will he do what my mom does? Okay. I got a question.
No, because she's a nurse. So I know what a nurse, it's the same as my kids complain, like, pretty much if you're not bleeding or have a limb barely hanging on, you're going to be fine. Just
I never got to stay home from school.
Yeah, it's hard to scam docs pretty much and nurses at home for sure. They're not going to let you get away with it. So I grew up with a dad, my dad was a doctor. So I, you know, I have things, I'm like, I think this is a problem. He's like, you're fine. And then about a week later, like, no, it turns out your finger was broken. So, you know, we have those things too. They're not going to be probably like that though.
Yeah. So I think, and I just think all of it's exacerbated by what's happening with COVID, and we'll jump into the COVID talk. I will say, I want to have you back to do maybe a more extensive conversation about it. And I really enjoyed, you know, you've done a lot of conversation. I mean, maybe this is the place where I ask about post-COVID paradox podcasts, but your episode 154 from December 9th with Dr. Monica Gandhi was really good, talking about a lot of different things. And you approached it in the We Are Libertarians way, which was very measured, not trying to scare people, taking things seriously, but throwing out a lot of the hysteria. It was very well balanced and very thoughtful, and I learned a lot from it. I think, you know, how have you tried as a doctor and a podcaster? I mean, because like I always say on this podcast, like, I haven't talked a lot about COVID. I just sort of checked out in the middle of 2020, because it's like nobody's listening. Everybody just wants to hear what their side has to say. They don't want to, like, it just sort of, I stopped paying attention to it because I don't know. You know what I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah, completely.
But I also, you know, once you get to something like the vaccine, like whether or not someone should take the vaccine is not, the opinion of me, a podcaster, should not factor into it. Now, if the government wants to violate my bodily autonomy and yours, then that does fall into my scope in course of my career. You know, what government action is different than the pandemic. And the way I've kind of approached all of this is there's the pandemic, how all of these things are operating, and then the government's response to it. And the government's response to it, I think, has obviously been lackluster, not worked, and I don't even think we're borderline tyrannical.
That's very kind of you.
I don't think it's borderline tyrannical anymore. But, you know, when you look at it as a doctor, someone who actually does understand all of this stuff, knows what a T cell is, knows, you know, what these different variations are, and carries, I think, a little bit more of a, I feel tremendous responsibility, like when I crack the microphone on the pandemic stuff. I mean, does it weigh on you more? Do you feel more confident knowing that you kind of know what you're talking about? I mean, how have you tried to approach conversing with other doctors in public about the pandemic and knowing what influence that might have on somebody?
This will come as a shock to you, but we do talk about the pandemic in the OR and other in the hospital all the time. In fact, it comes up all the time. I think, you know, the hard thing about this is that I don't profess to be any sort of expert in the sense that, you know, I'm not a virologist, I'm not an immunologist, I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm also not a public health policy expert, you know, so I, you know, no one is all those things. No one's probably even often one of those things, but
well, some people think they are.
Well, plenty of people think they are. And, right. And I at times do too. I think what I've tried to do in the show, and it's not any different with COVID, is I just try and learn things. And so people always ask me, like, you know, why, how do you find your subjects? What do you do? And I said, you know, I just see someone who writes something interesting, says something interesting, and I just want to learn more about it. And so that has been my approach. And my assumption is that people who are listening will want to learn with me. They're maybe find some interest too. And I don't know, from the people who listen to the show, it seems like I'm partially right, at least there. So my approach for this has been the same thing. I mean, I speak the language, and so I understand the basics, the fundamentals of, you know, the whether it's immunology or something. And so I know some stuff, and so I can talk to someone and understand it, which helps me. But, you know, the specifics of these things, I have to talk to people who know more than me, people who are infectious disease specialists or immunologists or virologists, people who do a PCR test for a living. Unless you talk to those people and actually, like, are truly curious. And then I think, you know, you have to have a lot of humility. I do my best to not talk in absolutes, because I don't feel like I know absolutely about anything in general anyways. I'm fairly certain in my principles and foundations of you know, how I think government should work or how medicine should work or what the pandemic, you know, what policy should be. But I'm always, I like to think that I will come measured in the sense that I'm not going to say anything with certainty if there's not certainty there. And so, as there's more evidence that mounts, you can feel more confident in your opinions. And I think when it comes to this pandemic, it has been a learning journey. It has really been a puzzle, an annoying one, and one that I would not want to embark upon. But it's that's how I've approached it. Like, you know, I'm trying to find the truth, right? And recognizing that no one person has the truth, and that there might be multiple truths in the sense of, you know, there might be 10 different ways to treat something. And if you're in medicine, you recognize this, as in both with most things in life, right? There's not one way to do anything. There's not one way to treat something. And many of them work well. Some of them you may say works better than others. One you might be just better at. And so I have a way I do anesthesia. My partner does anesthesia a different way. Patients both come out great at the end. And so that's just a different way of approaching the problem. And and successfully getting to the end. But you have to, you know, you have to have the basic foundations, obviously, what the knowledge is and stuff. But I guess that's how I've approached the pandemic. And I think, you know, looking at my track record, if there's a track record, I did an episode recently, a couple of months ago. You know, we were so right about about COVID when I talked to my friend who's an infectious disease doc in Billings. I mean, we were basically dead right about everything. And that was starting back in April of 2020, which is actually kind of disappointing because I feel like, why should I, a dumb anesthesiologist, know all this stuff? I mean, anesthesiologists, you kind of are, you know, about an inch deep of a mile wide of things. You know, some things, you know, obviously real well, but other things you just kind of know enough. You have to know enough cardiac physiology or pulmonary physiology to get by. And I mean, my immunology knowledge is basically from medical school, right? I can't say that I was, aside from giving preoperative antibiotics, I'm not like an antibiotic expert or dealing with viruses much, except to know that if I get a needle stick, I might get HIV, right? I mean, that's like for hepatitis. That's right. So those things I basically had to learn just from all the people I talk to and the things I read. And, you know, I think you look at, as someone who is not on team red or team blue, it makes it a lot easier actually to kind of look through, to cut through a lot of the noise. You can recognize people who are committed to one team or the other, for lack of a better sort of way of looking at it. And so you can say, okay, this person's partially right, this person's partially right, and the truth's somewhere, you know, between these people, right? And I think that's been helpful. And I think that's, you know, as a libertarian, I think it's a little bit easier dissecting politics for the same reason, right? Like, you can listen to Democrats, yeah, they got some things that make sense, the Republicans, but you can kind of, I guess, get through the noise and figure out where the truth or what the best policy or approach might be for solving a problem.
Yeah, there's definitely teams here, and it's discouraging yet not surprising in the least. You know, and I spent a lot of time early on trying to learn as much about things as I could, and you listen to, like, there was this one, I forget his name, I recommended him a lot early on. He was like a nurse practitioner from England who does these really good YouTube videos, and watched him religiously every day for like 4 or 5 months. I actually, when we moved, I just found the 3 reams of paper that I printed of information about the pandemic. And I printed it for a specific reason, because I knew 2 years later, 3 years later, we'd look back and we wouldn't have... things would have gotten distorted. Like, everything's in a distortion field in terms of information now. And so one of the things that I want to do is like sort through that and just kind of see what people said. But like, if you go back and watch Michael Osterholm on Joe Rogan, which was really the thing that got a lot of people, including myself, kind of like, oh, maybe we should take this seriously. Because we did a COVID-19 episode with one of our friends from Young Voices, and he's like, ah, don't worry about it. It's like SARS-V1. It's not going to be a big deal at all. You know, and you listen to Osterholm, and he like hit the panic button, and everybody freaked out because he said 800,000 people were going to die worldwide, right? So a lot of these predictions from just the virologist and epidemiologist from the very beginning, a lot of that was true. A lot of the charts that you see from, you know, people like a Jeffrey Tucker, a lot of that wasn't wrong either. You know, it's everybody had a point, but then now it's just sort of gotten to this place where everybody's hardened their position that, you know, I'm sure everybody had an experience with a family member over Christmas where you're just going, this thing that you're saying that you learned in July of 2020 does not apply anymore. Why are you doing this thing still? You know, it's like like masks. You know, I remember watching Fauci on one of these cable shows talking about how masks didn't work and it's a nice thing to do and maybe it'll stop the spit, but we really need to save it for PPP, so don't worry about it. But no, mask mandates aren't going to be effective. Now, I didn't wear a mask till like August 2020. You know, and then, you know, I'm going to the Dominican Republic and the, you know, here in Indianapolis, I don't know what it's like in Michigan, where you're at in the People's Republic of Michigan, but I don't have to wear a mask anywhere in Indiana, right? Like, the pandemic here was over in July of 2020. But in the airport, it's like, it's like worse, like somehow the pandemic has only gotten worse to the point that Fauci's now talking about mandatory vaccination to fly on airplanes. Meanwhile, the people who run the airlines and, you know, the DOD are saying the filtration system is good enough to not, you don't need masks. It's not that effective. I mean, but you look at some of the flip-flops that we've had, some of the inconsistencies, like first, everybody thinks if you're vaccinated, you can't spread the disease at all. Now, I mean, it's pretty obvious that vaccinated people can spread the new variant at least. And everybody's still kind of stuck in that mode of like, well, I don't want to be around a dirty anti-vaxxer, right? Like, I don't know. It's just the people in my life who are on team COVID, I don't, you know, they're so far off from reality because they watch the news. And then, you know, team anti-vax, they're like, I don't know, in some ways they're more informed. I don't know how to talk about this stuff because it's so emotional for people. So maybe you can help us kind of like figure that out. Like, is it just the polarization and information? Like, how do you suss that out when you think about how to communicate this stuff and the two sides that have developed and how far off base they really are from the information that you're gathering on your show?
Well, the big question, right? I think, you know, for me, when it comes to, it's two questions. One is the question, what do you do when it comes to like public policy and looking at the larger picture when it comes to, you know, large, like the countywide restrictions or statewide or federal? And, you know, you don't have much say over that. What I get a lot is, you know, questions from, I get nurses all the time and other docs who ask me, you know, should I get vaccinated? Or, which I think is kind of funny because I'm an anesthesiologist, right? And they're asking, but I think, you know, if you want to start your own podcast and become an expert, it's a really great way because it forces you to really get into skin stuff and you suddenly become an expert on accident.
At election time, who should I vote for
right, my exactly.
I don't know. You live in Oklahoma.
So what that has helped is I can talk to people who are kind of wherever they are in the spectrum. And I don't mean that as a libertarian sense. When someone comes to me, I think the first thing to do, and this is probably good for a physician in general, is to be empathetic and to understand that the people are coming to you with sincere questions, or they're coming from sort of angle, some angle. They have some sort of experiences, either lived or they've, you know, they know someone closely who's had problems or not had problems with COVID. And so I think you need to treat them with empathy. And by that, I mean, try and understand why they hold the positions they hold. Most likely, if you're talking to someone who is, you know, masks and vaccines and boosting and all this kind of stuff, like, you know, I don't know if we can have a family get together. I don't know, all this stuff. They're coming from, they just have a lot of fear and anxiety. Maybe they know someone who died from COVID because I think, you know, most people know people have been sick, maybe seriously sick.
That seems to be a common thing that I think you've hit on. The people that I know that are most afraid of COVID, A, they haven't had it yet, and B, they have lost someone or know someone that's been lost to COVID. And on the other side, people who are kind of on the anti-vax crowd know somebody that have had myocarditis or they passed away shortly after the vaccine. Like, there's, at this point, the people who are kind of like amped up one way or the other have had some experience. I think that's a good point.
And so I think once you figure out where they're coming from, I think then you just kind of, you're not going to change anyone's position, just like in bright politics. Like, you're not going to talk to someone and they're going to say, oh, you know what? Marxism is not going to work. I'm going to be a free market capitalist the rest, right? I mean, that never happens, right? If you talk to someone with empathy and understand where they're coming from and why they are, it's amazing what you can accomplish, right? I think I've gotten far more people vaccinated because I'm like, because I'm willing to listen to people who are really against vaccines, and I understand their arguments and I understand their reasonings. And some of them make sense. And some I'm like, you know what, that actually is not valid. But here's why I would recommend getting vaccinated or not, or whatever, you know. But I think, you know, what Med Twitter does, and it's been a real problem, and with public health, I'm just lumping that, is they have a very, you know, it is a, you're a bad person, or there's a lot of yelling. And whether it's on social media or even from commercials you watch TV, I mean, it is so one-sided, and there is a lack of any sort of thoughtful discussion or addressing people who have concerns aside from just saying, oh, they're idiots. I mean, that's pretty much what it comes down to. Or like, look at the hospital. We're overwhelmed. How could you're a terrible person for even entertaining that idea where it's probably, there's probably a reason that person feels that way. And, you know, you can just you can show them numbers. You can say it's actually really busy or whatever. And it's amazing how much you, how much success you can have with just showing people some facts and you're actually listening to them. Rarely do we listen to each other. And I think that's the, you know, you got to be empathetic and you actually have to listen. And then you don't just kind of drop truth bombs all the time. And I think that's, you just have a regular conversation. I don't know. I mean, that's, it sounds dumb, but I think that's probably the best way to ever to approach someone and not expect to change someone's position the first time you meet them. But yeah. Just, you know, you may be planting a seed of doubt. Maybe you're just saying, hey, here's something you might want to look into or whatever. And you'll be successful. I mean, some people are too far gone, so to speak, and they just need their tribal leader to tell them to call off the dogs. But the biggest thing for me from a frustration standpoint is big bureaucratic policies that don't make any sense that are, because they're bureaucratic policies, you can't adjust. For instance, I actually just tweeted this out today, but we have drinking fountains in our hospital. They're all turned off. We have known since last summer, 2020, so almost 18 months ago, that there is not any fomite, so like surface contamination that spreads COVID, almost zero. I'm pretty much zero. And yet we have turned off our drinking fountains. Now it's a small thing, whatever, right?
Sure.
It's I can't think of why people would turn off their drinking fountains unless A, they don't want people to drink. Well, I know they sell drinks in the cafeteria and we sell it all. So it's not like they don't want people to drink. Are they worried about people gathering at the drinking fountain? I've never been to the hospital and seen 50 people in line around the corner to get the drinking fountain.
Right.
I mean, it's, and so I actually liberated a drinking fountain today. So I plugged it in. I took the sign off the wall and I kind of hid the sign that said, you know, due to COVID-19, I don't know, maybe I'll get in trouble for this, but I think, you know, at some point we just have to accept the fact that when there are policies that we know that are foolish, we need to just, you know, just maybe need to, just a tiny bit of resistance. And, you know, I was at SVS last night helping a couple get some eyeglasses. And they too had, you know, it's a medical facility, which is always funny that you go into the optometrist's office and now I have to wear a mask, but I don't have to wear a mask anywhere else. It's really kind of strange, like next door, the pet food store. But, you know, they washed out all the glasses after you try them on. They have their drinking fountain turned off and they have a little, you know, footprint things on the, all these things that we know are of no benefit, right?
Yeah.
And I think.
Yeah. When you look at the spike in Victoria in Omicron COVID cases, when they have the most strict lockdowns in the world, you have forced vaccinations, strict, you can't go anywhere and do anything, huge contact tracing. You look at the numbers between Indiana and Michigan and the lockdowns that you experienced under Whitmer versus Holcomb, or the numbers between us and California or Florida and California. Like, California had all these strict restrictions and they're in the middle of the pack, as you mentioned on your podcast. Like, I guess it just, to me, having lived through the 9/11 era, why am I still taking my shoes off at the airport? It serves no real benefit other than Nobody wants to be the politician that reverses that. And when you start expanding the vaccine passport stuff to not allow unvaccinated people to go to restaurants, there's not going to be a recourse for it. You're going to have people who are abused. The system's not going to work because it will be underfunded. It will be, you know, it's like, even if you are on the team COVID camp, you know, you're not on my camp, which is like, it's immoral to force people to take a pharmaceutical product to you know, interact in the marketplace. Like, look at the utilitarian aspect of it. It's not working. It's not going to work. Why are we doing some of these things? And, you know, I got in trouble for using my cell phone in the customs and border area on the way back from the Dominican. And she's like, put your phone away. And I was like, why? She's like, because it's a rule. I said, how is me trying to FaceTime my stepdaughter a national security risk? Well, you can explain that to the customs, like, okay, so I'll just go to jail because I don't agree with your dumb rule. Like, you know, it's these dumb rules that we have lived under for 20 years that make no difference, and we're doing it all again. We haven't learned our lesson because 25% of the population is misinformed on how dangerous it is, and the other percent is, you know, misinformed on that it is dangerous. Like, that never, those two have to fight. I don't know. It's driving me crazy.
I'm with you. I feel the same way every day. And I think in many ways it's driven by fear, right? Like, you can kind of push through any sort of policy if you get people worried enough about it, one way or the other, right? And so I think that's the nice thing about this whole thing, I think, is that when it comes to vaccine passports specifically, is that there is not a utilitarian argument to do them, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could argue that there was a reason to do all these security checks. And if we had all this stuff, we could prevent bombs getting into the airports right. and stuff, right? I mean, there's a guy who tried to set his foot on fire, whatever it was. And of course,
Detroit. He was going to take you out. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. No one had actually noticed there's no one left in Detroit anyway. So, if that was, but there's no, you know, there's no argument for this sort of policy. Of course, you and I know that if this sticks around, that it will be expanded to other things that probably do make sense. Like you can't come in this restaurant, you get a polio vaccine, or, you know, there could be ones that are like very sensible in the sense that there are sensible vaccinations. But, you know, is that something that you want to have? You don't want to have that infrastructure in place, because there may be a time when there is a utilitarian argument, but there may not from a freedom standpoint and freedom movement and, you know, connecting your business, et cetera, that you don't want those things in place. And so you want to crush these things when you can. I mean, I do think we're in some way fortunate that this is acting just the way I expected the respiratory virus to act, in the sense that you cannot have lasting immunity to it, but you will, and I hesitate when I say that because it's confusing. You won't have sterilizing immunity to this virus. You'll have
meaning you cannot vaccinate.
You can't get infected,
yeah, right?
So this is the thing that's confusing. Of course, is that the vaccine was never intended, designed, expected to prevent you from getting infected. It is only designed to prevent you from getting a serious illness, hospitalization, death, etc. So it keeps it in the upper respiratory tract, which is where you want a normal cold is, right? It gets your sinuses, right. Maybe your nose, whatever. And you feel miserable for a couple of days and then you're fine. It doesn't cause a systemic problem with like your heart problem. Those things can happen. They do happen to people and kids, but they're very rare. And so that's what you want this virus to do. You want to have the long-term immunity, the cellular immunity with the T cells and B cells that say, hey, there's a problem. Let's go snuff it out. But you still get infected and you're still sick for a couple of days and probably can transmit it, which is all the virus cares about, right? Getting to the next person. But we have conflated what a vaccine does, assuming they're all the same, et cetera. And so people say, oh, see, it's not working, or people thinking that it's going to like some sort of force field, or if you just keep getting boosted enough, or you pick the right variant booster, you're going to be prevented from getting sick. That will never, ever, ever happen. I mean, I think that was our assumption when we were talking back in April, and that has borne out to be absolutely true.
I remember in the beginning of the pandemic, someone basically saying, like, even if you get a vaccine, and I remember being like kind of terrified by it, because it was a period in early summer where people were saying, well, these lockdowns could last 5 years. And one of their arguments was that you can't get a vaccine. You can't get a vaccine within 5 years. I think Gates was talking about it.
Like I was saying that. Yeah,
you can't. It'll take too long to get a vaccine. And if you do, it's a coronavirus, so it replicates fast. And so it's why you have the flu shot every year, is because you can't technically deal. I may be getting some of this wrong.
No, you're right that people are saying that. But
And so now it's the only solution and the only way that we're going to get out of it. I'll do this for you. And I have noticed in a lot of my liberal friends this attitude of, wait, so did I get lied to? Like, I was told that if I got this and did this, I could go back to regular life and it was going to go away. And now Omicron's here. And so did I just do this to keep myself out of the hospital? Like, I don't know, this spirit of get vaccinated for everybody kind of backfired as a message, because a lot of the people who, you know, were first in line are going, now I have to get a booster. Like, how many am I going to have? Like, so I think the messaging on this has largely been bad. I think the need to censor people has only made it worse. You know, California will put a warning on a bridge if it has a 0.007% chance of causing cancer, but not on the vaccine. And then people, you know, in the anti-vax crowd circulate the myocarditis stuff. Like there's just a lot of things that because there hasn't been a good conversation, in my opinion, about a lot of this stuff that has caused a lot of frustration and bad information. And it's left people confused, which is why I want to do this. I want people to listen to Dr. Eric Larson's podcast, The Paradox, because I think if you've heard how he is approaching this, you understand that he's going to bring the same level of scrutiny and skepticism that we try to apply here, you know, without like evaluating both sides and trying to come to a logical conclusion and find the truth as best as we can. But I want to do an episode with you, if you're okay with this, where people send us questions in advance about the pandemic, about the virus, about whatever, masks, the vaccines, all that kind of stuff. So you and I can, you can do the research to really understand the question and to find the best information. I'd love to do an episode where people write in and ask some of these foundational questions. I know I will have, I have gut assertions that I'd like to check out, but I don't have facts or real answers. So if you're willing to come back, I'd love to solicit, send your questions to editor@wearelibertarians.com. And then we do another episode specifically about the pandemic, COVID-19, vaccines, and try to get to an answer on some of this stuff if you're willing to do that.
I'd love to. And maybe when we come back, it'll all be gone.
Yes, right. Like, I'm thinking in 3 weeks, this will all be cleared up. That's my
opinion. This whole thing, I mean, it's already been 2 weeks. There's been 3 weeks. It should be done by then. Yeah.
Real briefly. So, yeah, please, we'd love to hear your questions. I want to know what's on your mind. I want to know what's kind of causing you some anxiety. Can I do this? Should I vaccinate my kids? All that kind of stuff. And, you know, so we can prepare a little bit. Thanks for listening to part one of my conversation with Dr. Eric Larson of the Paradox Podcast, the newest podcast here on the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Make sure you download his show, and you can catch part two of my conversation with him next week as we talk a little bit more about COVID, and we solicit your questions. If you have questions about COVID, please send those to us at editor@wearelibertarians.com, and then he and I are going to get together and have a podcast answering those questions. We know it's hard to find information out there that, both of these sides sound sort of right, so we're going to help him navigate some of that information. So please send your questions to editor@wearelibertarians.com.